threads of art, culture, and history. David Swatling creates an oral tapestry.
One problem we have is that the so-called dirt archaeologists consider everything to be of value for art history, but they want to tell museums you can't buy anymore. How can you tell a museum in Holland that they can't buy a piece from ancient Rome or from Cambodia or from the Han Dynasty in China? We all want to educate our citizens. We all love art. We want to enjoy it. But now the dirt archaeologists say, no, this is a horrifying situation. Everything in the ground is sacred. And this, for me, is something that should be shared around the world. People in Tokyo should be able to admire a Cycladic idol or a Greek vase. People in the United States should admire a Chinese object. If it were up to the dirt archaeologists, everything would stay in the ground or stay in the national museums.
Dr. Jerome Eisenberg is founder and editor of Minerva, the International Review of Ancient Art and Archaeology, which details news of the latest archaeological excavations, museum exhibitions, and fine arts fairs dealing in antiquities. Every issue also includes recent news of stolen art and artifacts, a time-dishonored tradition as old as man himself.
Whenever you had greed, you had looting. So it's not a question of artifacts as such. It's a question of man's greed and wanting to have something that the other person has. And also, when people conquer other people, they automatically take their property. When soldiers come into a town, they'll loot. So I suppose it's, as I say, going back many, probably 10,000 years, not just into ancient Near East or ancient Egypt. The greatest looting in the world was during the period of the Hellenistic rulers and the Roman emperors. Looting was on a vast scale there, Sulla, Caesar. They were in business to loot because that's the way they fed their soldiers and gave them their bonuses. Modern-day looting probably started, I would say, in the 18th century, late 18th century, when you had the Napoleonic Wars. The rulers themselves were looting. The soldiers were looting. You had treasures going from Italy to France. You had treasures going from Egypt to Italy, Egypt to France. You had the greatest international transfer of riches probably in the late 18th century and early 19th century. And what we call looting today is a minuscule thing in comparison.
There's an old Scottish proverb which says, "He that finds, keeps. He that loses, seeks." But according to Dr. Eisenberg, the 19th century coinage, losers, seekers, finders, keepers, is a bit too simplistic to explain the mass looting which occurred during that period.
One has to remember that in many of these countries, they were owned by other countries. So that, for example, Greece was owned by the Ottoman Empire. Syria, Lebanon, Egypt were all under foreign mandates. So the owners of these countries really didn't give a damn about the antiquities. For example, the Turkish rulers gave firmans or grants to their friends to take objects, to take treasures. People like Schliemann, for example, Elgin, they took these things at that time partially with full legality. And it was only later generations that respected their own treasures. This is especially true, for example, of things like the Elgin marbles, because at that time it was Turkish territory.
Whenever the subject of stolen art and antiquities arises, someone is sure to bring up the Elgin marbles, the collection of ancient Greek sculptures and architectural details in London's British Museum. Thomas Bruce, 7th Lord Elgin, was British ambassador to the Ottoman Empire from 1799 to 1803. A lover of art and antiquities, he expressed concern about the damage being done to important artworks in the temples of Greece. Fearing they would eventually be destroyed because of Turkish indifference, he petitioned the Sublime Porte and was authorized to take away any pieces of stone with old inscriptions or figures thereon. a series of shipments took the treasures to England, creating a storm of controversy that led to an investigation by Parliament. Elgin was assailed for rapacity, vandalism, and dishonesty by leading figures of the day, including Lord Byron. In 1810, Lord Elgin published a defense of his actions, which silenced most of his detractors. But the Greek government has frequently demanded return of the marbles ever since, most notably in recent years by its most outspoken Minister of Culture, Melina Mercuri.
She made it her stand. It was a very dramatic stand and a glorified stand to have our treasures returned to Athens. Meanwhile, the marbles in the Acropolis are suffering, and everything decayed away. They're actually replacing statuary on the Parthenon Hills with reproductions and bringing the sculptures inside the museum. So in a sense, although it's a difficult thing to say, Elgin saved the marbles.
The concept of rescuing art as opposed to stealing art, there seems to be kind of a muddy line there. But when is something being rescued and when is it being taken?
It depends upon the country. For example, it was completely legal to bring antiquities out of Egypt until into the 60s. You got export permits. Authorities looked the other way and gave export permits to friends on pieces that were even in government property, government storage depots. You had export permits in countries like Greece until 1930 when they passed their first laws. Most countries passing their first regulations on export of antiquities in the 30s and 40s, some as late as the 50s. That's when the concept started changing. And by the way, in many of these countries, they had very little interest in their own antiquities. It's a very difficult situation today when you weigh the values of different countries and what they regard as their treasures. For example, you have the extremists in Egypt today who say anything that is not Islamic is heresy, and they have no interest in this material. And literally, they would rather destroy it than save it. One of the problems we have is that generations later, the people in different countries have entirely different views on what they consider their art, their heritage. Only now do they consider certain things their heritage. For example, in Turkey, the only heritage they had was perhaps not just Ataturk, but let's say they're interested only in the Ottoman Empire. And the Greek and Roman antiquities in Turkey were considered foreign matter. And for the most part, it was the foreign archaeologists that did the excavation and saving of the treasures there.
In terms of this cultural heritage issue, there seem to be two views, one of sharing a cultural heritage internationally, and then another kind of nationalistic approach.
It depends upon the country, of course, but for example, in Egypt, you have now the dictum that not a single antiquity must leave our country. This applies to the smallest servant figurine that may be worth $100 or a scarab worth $20 or $30. Nothing can leave their country. Everything is precious. Everything in the soil cannot be touched. Meanwhile, they don't have the monies, they don't have the funds for any excavation, conservation, photography, publication. All they're interested in is that no object should leave their country. In doing this, what they're doing is losing tens of millions of dollars a year in support for excavation. And for example, even today in Egypt, much of the monies that the tourists pay for admission to the temples is diverted to other parts of their cultural programs.
As the owner of galleries in New York and London, which deal in the trade of antiquities, Dr. Eisenberg keeps a watchful eye on international attempts to regulate this trade. In the early 70s, UNESCO attempted to set guidelines, and more recently, at a 1995 convention in Rome, the International Institute for the Unification of Private Law, or UNIDROIT, set down more stringent rules. But most countries have been slow to ratify the agreement. For example, though Holland signed the UNIDROIT Treaty in 1996, it is yet to put the trade regulations into law. Dr. Eisenberg explained some of the difficulties.
Well, one of the problems with UNESCO is it didn't have teeth. It was a very, very general convention, and unfortunately many countries didn't adopt it. The United States only adopted UNESCO rather recently. One of the problems was that it didn't have sufficient sanctions in place that would be accepted internationally. Unfortunately, the new convention, UNIDROIT, leaves too many openings. For example, in Unitoi, they abandoned the principle of lex situ. That's a fancy Latin term, for weighing a case by the law of the land. If a country adopts unidroit, they abandon the lex situ, so that whatever they have in their courts means nothing. It's a very, very dangerous situation. Once five countries ratify unidroit, it's in operation 6 months after. But unfortunately, only the signatories are bound by it, only the people that also sign unidroit. So, for example, suppose Holland signs the Unidroit Convention. It means that a lot of the art trade, will stop in Holland. It'll flow to other countries. The English, the auction houses, Christie's, Sotheby's, I think, are horrified by the situation of Unidroit, because you can claim something tens of years afterwards. If they sell something at auction 30, 40, 50 years later, a country can say, this is a stolen piece, and we make a claim to it. It's a difficult thing because you have a lack of documentation in the art-rich countries. In Egypt, for example, Italy, there are hundreds of thousands of objects that have never been officially documented that are owned by the government. So what can they do when something is stolen? They don't have their own records. They don't have the funds. The governments will not give them money to record and document all of their treasures. Italy is now doing a very good job of catching up. Egypt is doing an exceptionally good job. Egypt is computerizing the objects in their museums now. Remarkably good effort. They're now, I think they have something like 50, 60, 70,000 objects on computer from the Cairo Museum. Before that, you could go into a depot in Cairo or in Egypt and probably take dozens of major objects out, and there would be no trace, official record of it. It's a very big problem. The objects of importance is another problem. In Unidroit, you have the determination that each country can make claims of objects of importance. Now, objects of importance can mean a fragment of a vase. It can be something for $100, for $10. If a scholar, if a scientist says it's an object of importance, the country accepts that definition. Unfortunately, Unidroit does not put a limit, a bottom line on the valuation. It would have been a very, very good move if they said, for example, as a guideline, an object of $10,000 or more is an object of importance. But this can be a small coin. It can be a key, an ancient bronze key. As I say, a broken vase. Object of importance is a horrifying concept.
It all seems so simple in the movies. Indiana Jones is the good guy keeping ancient artifacts out of the hands of the bad guys. But real life is rarely so black and white, and sometimes I wasn't entirely sure whose side Dr. Eisenberg was on.
One of the problems is that you cannot stop the collector. You can't stop the accumulator, such as myself. I'm a born collector. It's a question of saying, you can't collect anymore. And this is one of the things that many of the countries want to do. The scholars, the so-called dirt archaeologists, those people that do excavating, they say one should not collect. For example, Lord Rumfrew in England, who's a great scholar, but I think he doesn't weigh the value of collecting, the excitement of owning an object, the fascination of something, holding something in your hands that's thousands of years old, a piece of history. A coin of the Emperor Nero, a vase that was fashioned by an artist in the 6th century B.C. These are wonderful objects. Being surrounded by them is a passion. You can't say to somebody, you're going to stop collecting.
There is trade, though, in objects that are part of the living culture of people who are here today, that things that have been taken from their ancestors.
Oh, yes. You have, unfortunately, another problem. You have the living people knowing that the tombs of their ancestors have been desecrated. South American Indians, American Indians. Pieces have been taken from them that are actually ceremonial objects, religious objects. This is a situation that's intolerable. And hopefully, much of this material will be repatriated from museums. The American museums have made a very, very good effort to do this. Museums such as the Smithsonian Museum of Natural History, American Museum of Natural History. They are returning things that are considered to be totems, religious objects that are respected and venerated by the descendants of these people.
Are the attitudes of museums helping or hindering this problem? Because obviously, if they have collections that they've had for a long time, it would seem to me they want to keep their collections. Does that make it more difficult to put new guidelines into effect?
Unfortunately, you have some museum directors that are more anxious to please their trustees in buying important objects than being concerned for provenance. I think that it's the responsibility of any museum now to very carefully check the objects that they are buying and also to check the objects that they have to make sure that proper title is with the objects they bought, let's say, in the last 20, 30 years. At least people should check back before 1970s when UNESCO went into effect. And I think you'll find that we have a number of serious problems with major museums. Some museums will buy important objects and hide them, put them away for several years, such as was done, for example, with the Metropolitan Museum and their silver treasures that were reclaimed by Turkey. These were kept off exhibition for a number of years. Obviously, since they were not put on exhibition, they knew they had a problem. The problem shouldn't have existed in the first place. It's a difficult situation, and hopefully the publicity being brought out in the last several years will help to stem this, this, let's say, greed of acquisition.
But more than museum directors, it is dealers who get most of the bad press when it comes to shady dealings in antiquities.
Well, you have bad press with dealers because there are bad dealers. There are bad apples in every barrel. Unfortunately, there are dealers that think nothing of buying from the tumbaroli, the tomb robbers. There are dealers that will go to Italy, Greece, Egypt, deal with the tomb robbers, do active business with them. It's their way of life sometimes. You have people that were brought up in Near Eastern bazaars that have gone into, let's say, Europe, the United States, and become respectable dealers in galleries. But in tradition, they follow the rules and concepts of their fathers and grandfathers. You have some very unethical dealers, unfortunately. But I would say that the great majority of the trade is done by very reputable dealers. Some 5 years ago, the so-called good dealers organized the International Association of Dealers in Ancient Art. And this group is trying very, very seriously to promulgate information to the public and to the trade that we want to have these laws and regulations in effect, as long as they're not in extreme. Any good dealer, for example, will not buy from tomb robbers. Any good dealer will look for provenance for the location of the original source of a piece. A good dealer will not buy anything in a wall painting, a fresco, an architectural object without making sure that it does have legal provenance. This is a very easy thing to check. You have the International Foundation for Art Research. You have the foreign governments. If we have a treasure, let's say, of a wall painting from Egypt, it's a very easy thing to trace the tomb to find out whether the paintings were removed from Egypt legally back in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, or whether they were taken after that.
In 1990, armed criminals dressed as policemen bluffed their way into Boston's Gardner Museum and stole 13 paintings, including work by Rembrandt and Vermeer, worth an estimated $250 million, the largest single art heist in history. The paintings have never surfaced, and the thieves never caught. In 1991, the International Foundation for Art Research joined with the insurance industry and the art community to form the Art Loss Register, a computer database of stolen art and antiquities. Ronald Tauber and Anna Kislyuk head the New York office, one of six internationally.
We took the database that had been manually prepared and kept on in a non-computerized format, and then spent a fair amount of money developing the infrastructure under which we can keep that in a highly mechanized, computerized format. The database now has about 100,000 items and is growing at the rate of 10 or 15,000 items a year. And people think about this as art, as Rembrandts, because, of course, everyone's focused on the missing Rembrandt and Vermeer. And while those items are on a database, the more typical item is something that any individual might find in his own living room and that a thief who came in looking to steal whatever he could would find and would take that together with the family's silver, jewelry, anything else that he has. And we would put on our database any item that can be specifically described and that is unique, so that we have not only paintings, but sculpture and antiques. We've got lots of furniture on the database. And we find items. We find about 300 items a year, and that works out to somebody saying Eureka about once a day, either here or in London or in our other offices. So we then find items that have been stolen, not by sending out detectives, as you might think. We don't have a team of retired policemen looking for thieves, but what we do is search auction house catalogs and respond to inquiries. Now, we look at every auction house catalog that sent to us by all of the major auction houses, and in 1997, just to give you an idea of the scope, we examined individually about 400,000 auction house lots to see if anything is stolen. And we also respond to dealers who are either about to buy or sell an item, and to police who find items regularly and don't know what to do with it. And many police forces, most of them, are sophisticated enough to know that if they have a question about art, they will call us, or if not us, the FBI, the Federal Bureau of Investigation, who will in turn call us. And we are the place where people come to check who owned it before.
Have computers in general and networking improved the percentage of lost and stolen items that have been recovered?
I would say yes, because our database, which is an image and text database, with the capabilities that we have on this system, we can do searches for things that we never could search before. For example, we can get a very fuzzy description, as we call it, where it's fairly general but slightly specific, and come up with several possibilities. Prior to the development of our system, you really had to have a very specific search. You could really almost only search on the name of an artist. You could not search for example, a landscape with three cows and two sheep and a red house on the right-hand side. But now we can. And that obviously means you're much more likely to find that particular painting than you would have previously. Since many works of art and, for example, 19th century works or earlier, many of them aren't signed, and what you have really is only a description. In the fall of 1997, we identified a painting by Manet called Peaches, which had been stolen in 1977 in New York. So 20 years later, the painting, so to speak, surfaced, and my colleague here in New York identified it when we got a search from a dealer in another state. One story is about 3 years ago, there was a theft of six sculptures by the Russian artist Archipenko. They were being sent from Florida to New York for sale, and the driver of the vehicle in which they were being transported stopped at a motel overnight because of a heavy rainstorm. And when he got up the next morning, the vehicle had been broken into and the sculptures were gone. We put them in our database. They were registered and they were also published in our affiliate IFARS magazine. And a couple of months later, about 3 months later, we got a phone call from an auction house, and they said that told us they had received photographs of six Archipenko sculptures, which seemed to match the ones that we had published and registered as being stolen. It turned out, in fact, they were the same six sculptures. We informed the FBI, and the FBI did seize them from a pawn shop in Miami. Now, at the time of the theft, the sculptures had a reported value of $600,000. The pawnbroker had bought all six of these sculptures for $40. He apparently had no idea what these were, and only when a friend of his noticed the name on one of the bases and they took photographs and sent them to Christie's, that's sort of when they figured out how much and how valuable they might be. But prior to that, he said he had no idea. And he, in fact, talked what was possibly the thief down from $100.
In today's market, can stolen art still be sold for high amounts of money?
Well, I think that's a very good question. I think it'll be impossible to sell in a commercially open fashion the Vermeer or the Rembrandt that was stolen from the gardener or any of the very high-profile thefts. I think those, if they are sold, and I'm not sure they are sold in a quieter, backwater way in which the buyer knows its true history. But there are many, many items that have values in the tens of thousands, which of course can be sold, and it's our searching the catalogs that brings that trade to a halt. One of the interesting things that we find and that we often joke about is that when we search a catalog and we find something that's stolen, we of course have to call the auction house and we have to tell law enforcement, and increasingly we feel that we have to call a paramedic because the consignor, the person who bought the auction house, has fainted dead away. He had no idea it was stolen. When it gets to a commercial point, and if the item was stolen, almost always the person who brings it for sale didn't know its history.
Has the global information network improved the chances for things to be found these days, or is it just another tool?
Well, for us, it's really another tool. What has improved the chances of finding something are the power and speed of computing, and that we are able to maintain a database with images that is accessible to us very, very quickly and very accurately. Although we still must use, and we intend to use, individual human beings to do the searching, the items listed on the database are very readily accessible by computer searches. We, as a matter of policy, we won't post our losses, those things with are registered with us, on the internet. And people always ask us why we don't do that. And the reason is, when you think about it, is pretty clear. We don't want the thieves to know what's on our database. If a thief knows something is on our database, he's not going to bring it to the auction house, not going to bring it to the point of commerce, and it's going to go deeper underground. Similarly, if the owner of the theft victim didn't register it with us, and the thief is able to check that on the internet and find out that it's not registered, he's going to be very free to sell it. So our policy, which is what law enforcement wants us to do, not to publicize these things on the internet. But we do make use of that technology. We're a technologically advanced company, and if someone wants to register an item with us on the internet through email, we certainly do that. And we, as the years go by, I'm sure that we will be more and more reliant on advanced computer technology.
Is it possible that with organizations like the Art Loss Register, that basically art theft could become non-existent?
I don't think so. Art theft is a perennial problem. It's been with us really since the beginning of time, I'm almost willing to bet, and I think it will always be with us. In most cases, art theft is motivated by one of the most simpler or basic of sins, if you will, which is plain greed. And most of the time, that's it. People are stealing for the money, not for the love of the art. And people will always be stealing for money. And so art theft will always be with us.
It's more disappointing to me that the Indiana Jones of the 90s is a computer. My thanks to Robert Mierda for the technical production. I'm David Swatling. Thanks for listening.